This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Welcome to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs. My guest this week, Isabella Aura, a teacher from Finland. She's a researcher, a kindergarten teacher, and we are going to discuss the use in schools of stories, storification, games and game playing. Would you be willing to turn your school into Hogwarts, or Narnia, or Middle-earth? Let's find out about a school that tried exactly that.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
And welcome back. And my guest this week, as I said in the introduction, Isabella Aura from Tampere University and also an educator in Finland. What part of Finland are you currently in at the moment?
I am in Tampere, so it's somewhat in the central Finland, yeah.
And we were talking before we started recording. I had a lecturer who'd done a study of the Finnish schools. And if you say to people in the UK, education in Finland, almost the first thing they'll do is they'll say, oh, yes, they do it very well there. And there's a reputation because of international comparisons and so on that Finnish education is remarkably good. Do you feel that a sense in which you're part of an education system which the rest of the world admires?
Yes, I acknowledge that reputation, and I think it's mostly because of the high education that is required from the teachers here. So it is required to have a master's studies in educational sciences, and overall we give much freedom to teachers and give responsibility for their own teaching and how they form their pedagogical methods and all that. So we don't have that much regulation from the administrative side or any sort of benchmark. I mean, we have tests and benchmark tests, but not that much as, for example, in the US.
The UK is the assessment of teachers, and particularly inspection of schools, and how that has, and the controversy over the pressure that's placed on teachers. Mm-hmm. I got the impression from my previous guest and from you, of course, that it's a very different world and a world that appeals to me. I like the idea that teachers are given the opportunity to explore their own education and their own skills. And one of the themes I think is going to come out in our discussion is, you mentioned freedom. And one of the themes I think that's come out in past guests with me, because the vague theme of my show is what schools are for. I'm retired now. I taught for about 40 years. And I'm sort of looking back, as it were, so on education generally, and asking what it is we can do better and what it is we do. And one of the themes that's come out is the idea that I think the ability for children to play and explore, as much as the teacher's ability to play and explore with their own work, has been pushed out by pressures of exams and pressures to succeed and pressures of inspections, you know, and pressures generally to prepare students for a life of work. And I think something of what you're doing, what you did in your work, is trying to introduce an element of play back into teaching.
Yes, exactly. I highly agree that play is somewhat sort of neglected today. And it's controversial to the idea that we want successful business leaders and successful entrepreneurs and all that, that requires creativity and critical thinking that is only developed within play. And when children play and try to solve problems and understand the world around them. So I think it's quite weird that we try to tackle this by making students sit at desks and do assignment sheets and all that, that doesn't require that much, you know, individual thinking and all that.
It is what extraordinary paradox it is, really. You're right about the schools have moved increasingly to control and order in the UK. So the most, in some senses, high performing schools can often introduce very heavy handed levels of discipline. Mm-hmm. And you say walking down the corridors in a certain direction, discipline. I know this doesn't apply so much to the very young students, but certainly in secondary school and even in primary schools in this country, lots of discipline. And yet that's the very opposite of play. Now, you mentioned there that play and critical thinking go together. Mm-hmm. What's your experience of that in your research or your work and teaching? How does play help to explore looking at the world in that way, which questions?
Well, play is interesting phenomenon since it has been researched from the beginning of how we try to understand human mind and all that. So there's many theories around what exactly play is, and we don't know yet. We still are sort of figuring out, since we know that play is something different. It's something different from real life, and it's something special in a sense that usually only the people that are in the play, who are playing, know what the play is about. So it can be quite hard for outsiders to understand what's going on in the play, which is something I think we as adults find hard to find the value in play. If we look at children playing, we don't exactly understand what's going on there and what is the sort of pedagogical value of this, even though, in my opinion, not every activity that children do has to have a pedagogical value.
Yes. Yeah.
Because play in itself is fun, it's meaningful, it doesn't have a real outcome. Whereas school or, for example, games or any sort of different activity, they have an outcome that we are going for, that we are aiming for. So play in itself is the activity that allows us to explore and examine and understand different sort of events that go in our lives. Yeah, it can be really anything, yeah.
I'm glad you said it, but I'd like to explore in a minute what exactly play is. And of course, you say that's quite a surprisingly difficult task. Would you imagine, oh, there's children playing in the playground. I played as a kid. Go out to play, your parents say to you. But what exactly that is. Your research, so in this country, I wish teachers were required to do MAs. Well, I did an MA and I was given an afternoon off a week and not much encouragement to do it. And it was early in my career. And that can be quite a trial, really, and not much reward for doing higher education. So what led you from the MA? Also, tell me about your PhD research. That'd be a better question.
Yes. So I defended my dissertation a couple of weeks ago. And it started off with my studies in early childhood education, and I did my bachelor's and my master's thesis on children's gaming, since I'm a huge gamer myself, and I was interested in how digital games show in small kids' lives and social behavior, since that hasn't been investigated much, since it's quite new phenomena also. And when I graduated from the master's studies, I was working in a kindergarten for a while until the opportunity came to me to become a project researcher on a project that was about a real-life Hogwarts. So it was a school in the US that has been transformed to resemble the Hogwarts School of Wizardry from the Harry Potter series. Not from the outside, of course, right, but from the inside. And so they had this hallway that was filled with sort of paintings and decorations and all sorts of props fitting to the theme. And they had four classrooms for the seventh and eighth graders. And each of these classrooms represented one of the houses from Hogwarts. So Hufflepuff, Gryffindor, yes, Slytherin, yes, Ravenclaw. Yes. And they went through, I mean, the curriculum delivery was from the official guidelines, whatever, that they went through in terms of maths and science and English. But they were inside this sort of playful learning environment.
Yes.
And we want to know how this sort of environment affects their learning and behavior. So they wanted to have a project researcher to visit this said school. So that was my part in the project. And gradually from there, they sort of assumed that, okay, this is going to be a PhD then. And I was like, okay, I guess so. And so that's how it happened. And after 4 years, I'm here. I have another case in my dissertation, so not only the real-life Hogwarts, but another case from Finland also. So that combines into my dissertation. And And yeah, now I'm researcher in university, aim for continuing this sort of studies here.
So when you heard about this school, the Hogwarts School, mm-hmm. or the Harry Potter School, and you traveled to the United States?
Yes.
And what did you find when you went there? Were the teachers like in role, Mr. Snape, Professor Snape and Professor Umbridge? Or you wouldn't want to be any of those two. But yeah. So did you have to look for the Harry Potter-ness? It was on a board display, or was it really overt in the school?
One of the things that we wanted to look at, like how immersed were the teachers and the students in this team, and how exactly did it show in their daily lives? So we did find that some of the students did sort of imagine in their heads that, okay, I'm Hermione today, I'm going to this class, I'm going to do my best and all that. So it was sort of in their mindsets, which brings us maybe back to the playful mindset of maybe figuring out that I'm someone else today. So getting this role sort of, even though you don't maybe tell us to the other students, but they did also, because I was interviewing, having these focus groups with the students to gather data from the school, the students told me that at times they sort of referred to the teachers as Professor Snape, since the teacher was sort of in a bad mood today or something. So they sort of used the characters and the vocabulary from the stories and the theme. So that was quite fascinating, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And did it enter into all so for instance, in a so what age group was this again? What grades?
So 7th and 8th graders, so in between 12 to 14 year olds, yeah.
So if the teacher is thinking it's a maths lesson or the subject is mathematics, would the teacher remain in role or introduce it in some sort of role play sort of way? Or
not really.
Just to give a sort of practical example of.
Not really, no. It depended highly on the teachers on how much they wanted to use the theme itself. So, and also it was dependent on the subject they were going through that day. So there were examples, for example, in the science classroom when they were sort of familiarizing themselves with different sort of chemical liquids or whatever, the teachers could refer to the liquids as potions or making a magical spell or something. Yes. Like little snippets from here and there, but not really going that much to the theme. But yeah, it was highly dependent on the teachers and the subject of the day.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs. My guest this week, Isabella Aura, from Tampere in Finland. Isabella is a kindergarten teacher and researcher. We are discussing game playing and storytelling across the whole school. I think a few years ago, I remember, various times in my career, I think cross-curricular themes have been a feature in secondary school or in primary school, where you say this term, the theme is, or you know, things like the environment, or and you try to weave those into different subjects. You know, you can fit the environment into science and fit it into, also you can read, there are all sorts of books that relate to the future dystopian worlds where the environment's gone wrong and so on. So you could do cross-curricular. So was it more than that? Was it, in a sense, we'll get on to what a game might be, but was it in a sense the teachers were playing along with the students, they're involved in their fantasy world? Or was it simply, this is our theme is Harry Potter and next year our theme will be Charles Dickens or something?
That's an interesting question. I think This cross-curricular thing is very topical in Finland also at the moment, but within this school, it wasn't that much on the curricular themes as it was merely on the environment itself. And the transformation on the classrooms in itself was a really big effort from the teachers. So they had done the transformation themselves by renovating the furniture and buying stuff from flea markets and all that. So I don't think they're going to change the theme yearly or anything like that.
That could, rebellion among the teachers.
Yes, that could be a very expensive transformation. So, but that's an interesting question on this sort of how to choose these sort of themes and how to choose these sort of topics, since they can be topical at the moment, but not tomorrow anymore. So maybe the Harry Potter theme was chosen obviously because the teachers were huge fans, but also they wanted to convey this sort of message from the story itself, since the school was located in this sort of rural area with poor home conditions and students coming from unemployed houses and all that. So the teachers wanted to convey this message that in the story Harry comes from poor home conditions and the Hogwarts is sort of an escape for him from the home conditions to be with whatever he wants to be. So this was the main message that the teachers wanted to deliver, so they can rise above the circumstances by coming to school.
So it's not so much that you're going to say, right, today in the maths lesson we are looking at mathematics within, you know, how a spell might be constructed in a mathematical formula or in sight and so on. Actually what we're all doing is playing a sort of fantasy, which is a bit like the experience of reading the book itself. I mean, it is a very powerful, I remember first encountering Harry Potter with my kids. And that first bit, you know, the first Harry Potter bit, there's always no kid who can forget that. The sense that someone turns up at your house and tells you you're a wizard kind of thing. And you say, oh, yes, that is the dream of escaping the bounds of all the material difficulties I might have. And school becomes that place, that magical place. So that was trying to create that sense of here's a special experience. Here's a magical place.
Yes, sort of an escapism from the real struggles that they faced.
Yes. There was a survey in this country asking students about what their ideal school would be. And some kids answered it with things like lots of sweets and things. but when they answered it, but actually thought about it, kids said, well, things like, I want to be listened to. I want to have more autonomy. I want to like and trust my teachers. I want them to like and trust me. And quite a few of them referred to Hogwarts. Saying that, you know, they'd like to live there and they'd like to have the freedom to explore or something of that kind. You know, the idea of that so many children's books are about going away from home and having the autonomy to, you know, swallows and Amazons or Narnia or somewhere like that.
That's quite sweet, but also quite weird, since I think the teachers in Hogwarts are not quite ideal. I mean, they are big bullies in the books, and that's funny that students find that sort of better.
It is. It's very much a model of an English public school of some kind. You know, you go away into the country and the teachers brutalize you. It's okay. And yet, I think the going away and being given powers and so on.
Yes, that was one of the themes that came up in the focus groups, this sort of sense of transportation that they felt like, I mean, obviously it's individual how they experience the environment and the activities there, but it was a big topic among the students that they felt like they were inside the story somehow, that they sort of entered into the books if they wanted to, that in their mindsets. And as I said, this sort of escapism from other boring or some more serious stuff.
That's interesting, that idea of entering into a world, a narrative and so on, because what little experience I have of game playing, and my daughter is certainly a great game player. And the period of time that moved from quite unsophisticated presentations of imaginary worlds to very sophisticated presentations of imaginary worlds. Well, that must be the attraction of, I mean, when my daughter was quite small, she was only 6 or 7, something like that. A game she would like to play was basically, it was a farm. And they potted around the farm, building and planting and planting and building. It took ages and ages. And they'd say, oh, the crops are going to be developed. I've got some points and I've got to develop, and so on. Uh-huh. It was in entering into a fantasy world. So this generation, your generation, I suppose, my generation, well, now I can do this part. I'm not so an old crusty. I can operate a computer. Lots of, in a sense, people have tended, the popular narrative has tended to be students are wasting their time, or young people should get out and be in the fresh air. That's not the real world, and we should be rather concerned about entry into imaginary environments. Is there a concern that games aren't the real world, and that there is too much fantasy? Too much imaginary, that's how I didn't like to say it as I said it, really.
Too much imaginary, too much fantasy, and too much playing in kids' lives. I don't think that's a serious problem that we are facing. This sort of repetition in our history of culture, and this sort of moral panic that we have over kids that repeats itself. For example, when the radio came, parents were concerned that the kids listen to the radio too much, and then there was television, and now there's games. So it repeats itself. I know that there's some real concerns, for example, like excessive playing when sort of the other life is suffering from it in terms of physical activity and all that. But entering into different realities and different narratives, I don't see much concerns about that, since it's powerful tool to learn things and understand things and seeing other people's perspectives, learning empathy, yes, creativity, as we already talked about. So there's many benefits on that, but I mean I'm not expert on games per se or game education, but I can say that there's responsibility from parents to see what sort of games they play. As you told me that you were knowledgeable about what your daughter was playing, so you were aware that it wasn't killing zombies, so that it's sort of age appropriate, let's say that. So yes, that's important to know the quality and who are they playing with and sort of that kind of aspects. Yeah.
That was a big thing when I was a kid. You know? Okay. Don't watch that. My dad used to say, well, that's American television. Don't watch too much of that. Cowboys and such like. I think he was worried. I don't know what he was worried about. He was worried about some sort of, it wasn't connecting with the life I was going to lead, or it was just American. I don't know.
Until you became a normal person.
So I ran out into the street firing off 6 guns and such. It didn't end up badly. Another theme that that comes up when you talk about this is the difference between listening to an audiobook and reading a book, or playing on a computer, which enters you into a fantasy world, or going into the street with your friends and concocting a fantasy world. And people say, well, this is what we should be worried about, is the it being done for you kind of quality. That mm-hmm. there's a mental effort to read a book, which is less so when you listen to a book. I don't agree with that at all, actually. And there's a mental effort that's made in fantasy, as opposed to be your, it's constructed by very clever people in Silicon Valley somewhere. I mean, is that a possibility that students will lose their ability to initiate and create?
Mm. Yes, I understand a concern, and there's point in that it hinders the educational value of, for example, learning to read and such. In my research, the idea of entering into the story, it tries to capture all these sort of different aspects of, for example, a story. So within this school that I was studying, they were both reading the books, the Harry Potter books, they were listening to them, they were doing assignments around the characters and plot development and all that. So it sort of combines these different views and different aspects to learn from the story, which I think is quite obviously ambitious, that it requires some sort of resources from the school system and from the teachers. But it's a way of tackling this sort of placing things against each other, having this sort of versus thinking. I don't know whether it's sort of meaningful to have these conversations on which one is better if you do them both.
Yes, and I'm sure it's part of a generalized, the world is changing and it's not the way we remember it, which is always a sort of concern. When I was at school, we didn't do this, or when I was at school, we did do this. And we tend to place all sorts of values on the way particularly children behave and act, and good play and bad play and good games and good books. I mean, I was thinking of Harry Potter. In some states in the United States, Harry Potter is frowned upon because of its magic. It's apparent.
Well, some sort of Satanism.
But that clearly, the school where you were, where was this school, by the way?
It was in Alabama, so very deep south.
That's pretty conservative zone. So they.
There was some concerns coming from parents around this book, but when they saw the value that, or the change that happened within the students and within the school itself, they sort of were okay with it. So they sort of had these pros and cons, and okay, maybe this bit of wizardry is okay.
What did you see in terms of the value and added value that it gave to the school? Were you won over by it as well? Did you think this is a thing we can learn from?
I think it has huge potential. There are so many benefits for, in terms of the school behavior and social behavior, since the kids told me it was easier to make friends since they had this shared interest and experience of the school. And yes, it was shown in decreased misconduct, and they didn't have detentions anymore since students saw the effort that the teachers made to the environment, so they didn't want to mess up with it. Yes, so that was obviously beneficial for teachers too. But we need to consider that there's some level of novelty effect here, since that was a quite new transformation within the school. And if the students sort of get bored with it or get used to it, they might behave otherwise. But they told me that they were very proud of the school and people like me going there from across the globe. The students told me that it's sort of, they felt very proud of the school, so they wanted to take care of it and keep up the reputation of the school.
So they sort of bought into, they were participating in a joint enterprise which they all thought was valuable and and to be admired and unusual. And as you say, you might go back there. Have you thought of going back there and seeing, you know, how's it going after 5 years or whatever?
Sure, that would be interesting. I don't know if they want me there anymore. But...
yes, no, whether, as you say, whether the Harry Potter has worn a bit thin, or whether, because schools infinitely renew themselves. The students who are finding a novelty at the moment are gone and graduated out of the school and, you know, will grow up, and new ones will come in.
Yes, so within this school, I think there was other classrooms also that had different themes, but we were concentrating on the Harry Potter theme, or the Harry Potter hallway, since that was the most immersing one. There were themes of Disney or Star Wars, but they weren't that much in detail there. But it was interesting in a way that, for example, the 5th and 6th graders were very, very much looking forward to moving on to 7th and 8th grade, so they get to go to Hogwarts. So that was only a part of their lives. And after that, they obviously go to high school and all that. So it's sort of a short time period within their lives. But talking also with the graduates of the school, they were telling me that they very much missed the school and they felt that it was a very impactful time of their lives.
Wonderful. Before we get into storification, you mentioned another school, that was a school in Finland that used a similar approach, or?
Yes, exactly. I mean, actually, it's not a school per se. It's a company that provides this sort of educational products to schools. So it's a purchasable thing for schools and municipalities, but it's highly popular in Finland. So within that product, the students actually go outside of the school, and this sort of separate environment that simulates a society for the students. So they get to role play adults for one day. So they get to pay taxes and do work and all that stuff.
And that's, as you say, that's quite popular in Finland. And
yes, almost all of the sixth graders take part in it. So,
and I can remember lots of people will say, look back at their school days and they say, what do you remember? It was sobering for teachers to ask a student, what do you remember of school? And of course, the things that often they remember are those moments where the boundaries are broken a bit. You went on the trip up into the woods and the mountains, you climbed things, went down potholes and so on. And there was an element of adventure. So we had to overcome this, so we had to jump in the lake or whatever. And that sense of overcoming problems, that's the narrative arc, isn't it? You know, there you are, you didn't want to do this, you've got to go on this journey, and eventually you'll arrive back safe and sound. And that's almost the perfect story.
There's very much potential on this sort of visceral memory that these sort of experiences give us. So going somewhere else and experiencing things in a physical environment. I know there's many sort of digital experiences nowadays provided for schools if they don't get to have this sort of museum visits or whatever. But there's very much value on going somewhere and having these sort of tangible elements and objects you can grab and you can sense stuff. So there's so much things that you can't really do in digital environments yet, at least.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news, is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Burble Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Burble Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey by Teacher Tap asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs. You're listening to the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs. My guest this week, Isabella Aura, from Tampere in Finland. Isabella is a kindergarten teacher and researcher. We are discussing game playing and storytelling across the whole school.
Yeah, narrative. The narrative art, telling stories. Reading time was one of my favourites when I was in primary school. They would say, it's a Friday afternoon and we're going to get the book. And whatever the book was, the teacher would all put their heads down and listen. And she'd start reading the book. So storying, and kids love stories. They immerse themselves in stories. What is storification? Do you mean something more than that by the term storification?
Yes. That's exactly the point where you enter the story. So you can be part of it. You can change the way the story goes. You can be a character in the story. And that's sort of diminishing the gap between the listener and the storyteller. And it's close to the term of gamification, where you sort of take this sort of different elements from a game or from a story and put there somewhere that isn't a game or story. And that is something that I think it's already done a lot in schools, have been always done, sort of storytelling and creating characters and role play and all that's included in the activity. But the term itself, that storification, is not that much used yet. But I think it's valuable in terms of sort of bringing research and the practical applications together. Since, for example, in my research, it was quite hard to find these sort of experiences that are done in schools, since we don't have a word for it. We have all sorts of narrative-centered environments or story-based learning and all that, but it's sort of all over the place. So that's why I wanted to use this storification term, so that it would become as utilized as gamification is nowadays.
What is the difference between storification? What do you mean by the term gamification?
So gamification is, in a simplest way, you make a non-game a gameful experience. So, for example, I don't know if you have those in the UK, but different sort of bonus systems that shops use. I'm sure you have those. So that's sort of simple gamification of, if you buy more products, you get points and you sort of level up and you are a prime customer, and then you get more discounts. So that's sort of simple gamification of, since we understand points, levels, badges, achievement, what are progress bars, that are sort of game elements. And we take those elements and put them somewhere else that isn't a game. So, for example, applications of banks or shops or activity trackers or whatever. So that's sort of simple gamification. But by gamification, we can also mean this sort of wider change in the society and culture in which we try to sort of get away from boredom and get away from seriousness. So we try to be more gameful and playful in mandatory tasks like washing the dishes or paying taxes. So we try to make those fun and more interesting for us. So that's also something that is called gamification today.
I'm thinking of the scene from Mary Poppins.
Yes.
Where she gets them to tidy the room.
Yes. That's actually one of the examples that I use in my lectures.
A task isn't...
There's an element of fun.
A job half done is element of fun. Oh, goodness me. Yeah, I've watched that film so many times with my girls. Yes. And when I was a kid, actually, it's at the cinema.
In every job that must be done, it's an element of fun. So I guess she uses that when they're cleaning the house and all.
Yes, and there's that sense in which the young people in the film are at first not convinced, especially the boy. And what? You're basically telling us to tidy up.
Yes.
And then she makes it fun by...
Yes. So that showcases that it isn't anything new. I mean, people have always done this. They have always gamified or made their lives more playful in order to get themselves to do something boring.
That parental thing, what are we going to do? We're going to play helping mum and dad wash up. What's the game in this? Yeah. And so in a school, it might be through things that I'm sure are commonplace, and many people listening to this will say, I recognize that, which is points and games and competitions and all the things that can be introduced in the subjects.
Yes, I'm sure the teachers are very aware of it, but now you have a word for it. Since school is obviously mandatory for students, it's something that they have to do, whereas play should be voluntary, play should be interesting in itself. So implementing play and playful things to schools, it's sort of a paradoxal, since obviously students can choose if they want to participate, and that can take the fun out of the play.
It can, and I think that taking the fun out of the plays is all too common in schools, because there's a tendency among teachers to say, right, this is the world of childhood, and play and fantasy and stories in the afternoon, going out on the playground and running around. And that kind of sense in which you never did it as a teacher, you want to say, but one day you'll have to get a proper job, or one day you'll have to go out to the world of work. And there's a world out there of adulthood which is nothing fun about it. And so you have a sense of, particularly maybe in secondary school more, but revealing to students the hard realities. So I don't think motivates anybody.
Yes.
But there's a tendency to do it, I feel.
Mm. Yeah, and I think there's a place and time for sitting at desks and doing boring stuff, since that's a part of our lives. But I think some sort of balance between having these playful activities and practicing being a boring adult is important. Mm.
But I'll bet that people in careers they enjoy, whether it is teaching or working in a shop or whatever they enjoy, there'll be a sense of playfulness.
They'll incorporate
it with their colleagues in the kind of little routines they have with the jokes they make and the games people play.
Yes, and that's also being playful. I mean, we as adults don't recognize the playful aspects of our lives as much as we do from our children's life, as the playfulness in adults is quite different than kids. Like you said, joking around or scrolling through memes or finding typos in official templates or whatever. That's sort of adults being playful. And that's something that we should maybe explore more and see from our lives that, okay, I was quite playful today. And that maybe brings something new.
I think it does. Yeah. And I'll bet it encourages creativity. And I'll bet it encourages better relationships between situations where someone would say it masks the hierarchy, or the boss is still the boss and you're not the boss, and so on. If you work within a playful environment, that's simply a kind of illusion that you're all in this together in some way. But it does create, I think, a bit better relationships where if you overtly demonstrate the fact that you're powerless and other people are in charge of you, you're not inclined to engage in the work, to be creative, to be exploratory, to share your ideas. I remember reading a book a few years called Banana Time. It was a work study.
Something that I use in my lectures, yeah. You are very knowledgeable about gamification, I think. Yes. So was it that someone brought a banana every day to work and someone stole it and they had to figure out who was it? And yeah, there was a way of bringing the work community together more.
And they would hide the banana, and then there's someone else again. And the guy with the banana would sort of enter into the game. Oh, where's it going? And they put it places where they could deliberately take it away.
Yes, that's a part of it. I mean, a way of gamifying work conditions. And yeah.
Where we might be going in terms of technology, in terms of computing, where will it take us, and how might this apply to education if we are living in a world that's increasingly able to create gameful fantasy world? I'm thinking of the world of Meta, the idea of the metaverse that Mark Zuckerberg was creating. One day you'll think of the metaverse as another, a sort of extension to your real life.
Yes.
Really exist in some ways, but do you see that as some sort of future in that direction?
That is a big topic in our research group of gamification group that is called the whole metaverse and creating extended realities and sort of producing this digital version of yourself. There's lots of things to research there and see the potential of where it takes us. But at the same time, my research tries to prove that there's potential and value in physical face-to-face interaction. So this is an interesting position here to be within this sort of huge transformation in our reality, whereas I sort of try to go back a bit. But I hope at least that in the future we have some sort of balance between these things, since we know that humans crave for this physical interaction and social communities and being part of something that I don't know if we can fully facilitate in digital realms.
I'm imagining groups of your colleagues sort of sitting, staring at screens doing this, and you're saying, let's do this.
Yeah, no, I see the value in both. Let's say that.
And the, as you say, it's a very ancient thing to enter into a game. If you watch children play, often they set things up. So they'll say, "Let's we're on an island," or this, were they using dolls, or they're using soldiers or teddy bears, or beyond that, when they're always in the street. I can remember going on adventures with my friends where you turn just a bit of old scrubby woodland into the Amazonian jungle, and climb trees and build a fort, and the fort had to be defended and so on. That form of gaming or fantasy must be so natural to children. Mm-hmm. But what worries me in a sense is that, as drawing is so natural to children, singing is natural to children. Kids listen to you didn't sing, but by the time you get to about 13 or 14, students start to tell you they can't draw and they can't sing. Mm. And that gaming is a bit silly or something, or fantasy games, and they want to do something else. And so it's almost as if we don't, you said we all do play, but we tend to, something about our society discourages children to carry on playing.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this sort of research to encourage play and playing, since it's sort of discouraged within the school systems and within our lives. But it's, yeah, I think teachers also sort of need these reminders of the importance and value of play. And it's true that it changes the form when we grow up, that it doesn't have to be the same way that we played as children. But there's different forms of play and playing. And seeing, I mean, obviously it has to be age appropriate, but for example, the case in Finland that I had in my dissertation, the environment that the children role play as adults, that's somehow sort of, I mean, it is playing, but it isn't sort of introduced to them in that way. It's sort of hidden within the tasks that they have to do, and the role is sort of, it's easy for them to go into the role whether they don't even realize it. And after the experience, they might understand that, okay, I was sort of playing in there, even though it doesn't maybe feel like that. So that's maybe one way of implementing this sort of playful and role play into teenagers' education.
Yes, I remember some years ago I taught at some groups called sixth formers. They were in this country, they were between the ages of 16 and 18. And they're all doing quite severe sort of subjects, economics and politics and history and such like. And we took them away to North Wales. And one day they said, right, well, today we're just going, for no reason particularly. There was lots of study. It was a study group. So they did some study. They had some lectures and things. But also we said, today we're just going down to the beach. And it was a great wide sandy beach. And within 5 minutes of being on the beach, all these 17-year-olds were digging away and building sandcastles, and they built the most elaborate town. I mean, they would like the trend. They put a moat around the side of it. They put a bridge across. They found an old plank. There were shells going on as things. I thought, yep, okay. You just that's the bit you're going to remember.
Yes.
And it was fun. And the sand, what great stuff sand is.
Yes.
For creating fantasy.
That's awesome, and that's one of the responsibilities for adults to bring kids into these environments that facilitate play in themselves. And now that you mentioned politics and economics and history education, within those subjects, role play and this sort of LARPing is very big, since there's very complex things you have to learn about history and about sort of relationships between from characters from politics and dictators and such. So that's one way of sort of getting to know the field and the subject by giving roles to students and sort of reenacting the events of history.
And you could explore some pretty heavy duties, emotionally powerful ideas.
Yes, it's a safe
in-game.
Yes, it's a safe environment to explore the meanings and relationships, and it's a safe environment for that. You can only discuss about the consequences and ethical concerns and all that.
It's a bit like, I mean, the Harry Potter books, there's a fair amount of death and danger in Harry Potter. And there's, as in Grimm's fairy tales or any childhood fairy tale, There's a way in which the child is exploring death and the future and uncertainty and loss of people and so on. Mm-hmm. And so right the way through education, you could say, well, if you want to deal with some moral and ethical problems.
And for example, in the Hogwarts school, they discussed the events of the books. So they had moral discussions whether Harry did the right thing in certain part of the book. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of further brought into the daily lives of the students. So it didn't stay only as a book event, but they were reflecting that on their current relationships and friendships and how they treat other people and all that.
Isabella, we're coming to an end now. So one last question I'll ask you is that I started by saying Finland has a reputation of having a very good education system. And one of the, do you think that Finland, one of its advantages is that it's more open to the idea of play and fun in schools? And I'm thinking of things like, in this country, school uniforms and discipline and the pressure to succeed in a very, very exam-heavy system. So we have lots and lots of exams to exam students at least three major times in their career as they go through schools. And much will depend on their exams. We're not as bad as South Korea or somewhere like that, but it's nonetheless, there's a sense in which school is about the serious business of succeeding or, worse, failing. Does Finland have something to teach us all about the, do you think? I don't know if making you the spokesperson for Finnish education, but
yeah, no pressure.
Is there something playful we could learn from Finnish schools?
We put high importance on well-being of students and not so much on the benchmarking test or whatever. And obviously that can show, for example, in the PISA results, we have dropped a bit from the history results, but I don't think there's much concern there since there's that are measurable. There are things that can be assessed formally, like maths or science, but we can't really measure, for example, social skills or creativity or how you cope as a citizen in your future. So we need to consider children as people and not as future employees. And that's maybe something that we need to shift in our thinking when we are educating the children of today.
Thank you for that thought. I completely and 100% agree that. And I think that if anything I've learned in my teaching career and through talking to people like yourself, it's that game playing and storification is vital to education. And I've been delighted to hear about your work. So Isabella, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that brings to an end this episode of the Friday Morning Break with John Gibbs, as I continue to explore, after a career in education, what schools are for. My guest this week was teacher and educator and researcher Isabella Alder, who teaches in Tampere in Finland. I hope you enjoyed our discussion of the importance of play, fun, games and storification, embedding stories right across the school. Well, of course, I guess we embed stories right across our society, for good and ill. But certainly in school, reclaiming a sense of fun and binding students together through a communal enterprise. Well, I guess that is something of what schools are for. If you've enjoyed this discussion and you'd like to listen to it again, you can find it on Spotify or the Teachers Talk Radio website. You can join me again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.